And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast live on a Tuesday morning. And I am thrilled to be joined to commemorate. You might have heard the 10-year anniversary of a little event called The Decision is coming up. So there's nobody better on planet Earth other than maybe like Maverick Carter and LeBron James to talk about The Decision with an ESPN senior something. I don't know your title. Mr. Brian Windhorst, how are you?
Hi, Zach. How's it going?
I'm good, man. I forgot you were at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Cleveland.com, when The Decision went down.
And I loved my days at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I don't know if I was ever happier than the 2 years I spent there covering the Cavs. They had that, you know, glorious 260-win seasons the years I was there. I loved it, but it couldn't last. It definitely couldn't last. And I knew that during the decision time that lots of things are going to be changing for sure. And
so I still think LeBron's all-time best playoff series is the 2009 conference finals against Orlando. 39-9-9 in a losing effort and a couple of monstrous clutch moments, including the buzzer beater to win game two. And I will have to say, I remember you when you were covering the Cavs for the Plain Dealer, you sat courtside and your daily or every game you would write little notes, bullet points on what you heard and saw from that seat. That is like, those were all-time great gems, and that's what when people wonder, what are we losing from courtside seats? You know, all of the media is whining. I get that. Like, oh, it's really like that's beyond first world problems to complain about your seating at an NBA game, but you are missing that. And that I just vividly remember. I would scour that thing. That was one of my all-time favorite things.
That was a strange time in media. We were learning so much, and one of the things that started happening was my post game blogs, which included all of those little news, nuggets, basically, started getting more. You know, the thing about it was when you had a newspaper, you just put it out in the world, and you just assumed what you put on the front page got read more, but you didn't really know. Well, once we started being able to track what people clicked on things and how much they scrolled through and everything, people started realizing that what I was writing about, those little nuggets were getting more read than the game stories.
They were amazing. It was great.
Yeah.
It was great. Before we get to the decision, let's actually do some news real quickly. Look, I've said my piece already last week on my podcast with Kevin Pelton about whether or not the NBA quote unquote should cancel the season. I'm not going to reiterate that. If you want my view on it and Kevin Pelton's view, listen to that podcast. Nothing has really changed since then. News wise, last night, DeAndre Jordan announced that he has the coronavirus and will not go to Orlando. Spencer Dinwiddie has the coronavirus and may or may not go to Orlando. And suddenly, if both of those players don't go, the Nets are incredibly thin. And for the 500 fans who actually care about the Brooklyn Nets, they are six games up on the Washington Wizards, who are ninth. For purposes of the play-in tournament, the Nets are really two games up
on
the Washington Wizards.
That's right.
Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that Orlando at full strength or almost full strength, probably minus Jonathan Isaac, moves up to seventh. In the event, again, that Dinwiddie doesn't come and the Nets are super shorthanded, the Wizards need to pick up two games on the Nets to force a play-in tournament, and then they would need to beat the Nets twice, unless by some miracle they tie the Nets, which won't happen. So, and I think the Wizards can look at this and say, if all our remaining guys come, remember, Davis Bertans is not coming, big part of their team this year. If all of our guys come, if Dinwiddie doesn't come, all of a sudden, we have a chance to make the playoffs, which, laugh at them if you want, and no one has laughed more about the Wizards' inclusion in this thing than I have. It's ridiculous that they're invited, but a playoff appearance is a playoff appearance, and it would be a nice for a team that had almost no expectations coming into the season with John Wall's injury, be a nice feather in their cap to get destroyed by the Bucks in the first round. But you know, look, it's not something to totally laugh at. And so, if you look at their respective schedules for these last eight games, it's not crazy that Washington could make up two games against the Nets. In fact, here are their first two games. Brooklyn starts with Orlando and then Washington. Washington starts with Phoenix and then Brooklyn. If Washington goes 2-0, and again, Phoenix and Brooklyn goes 0-2, you're tied, right? You're not tied, but you're effectively, you know, in the play-in stage right off the bat with six games to go. Now, from there, both teams have much stiffer schedules and lots of variables will happen. But, like, all of a sudden, Washington's got to be looking at this like, okay, the door's open, right?
Yeah, I mean, by the way, speaking of, I mean, Phoenix, who knows how many of their guys are going to be there because they have three or four people tested positive. I don't know how many of their guys are going to be able to be back. So who knows what that game's even going to be. So, you know, the thing is there's more money involved for everybody if you make the playoffs. And, you know, normally the, you know, getting extra money in the first round is not that big of a deal. But for all these guys who have already lost money out of their paychecks, it matters. And I can tell you to the organization, they get paid a lot of money on their RSN deals for playoff games. And so this stuff is going to matter how the organization approaches it. And that stuff's going to matter. And I don't know if that's enough to make sure all of them get on that plane, in a week, but it could contribute to that. And, the other thing is, you know, Washington has a young team, you know, even though their core players are older, they have a young team and this stuff is going to be meaningful. So if I was Washington a week ago, I might have been just saying, all right, let's go down there and go through our motions and fulfill our obligations. But I don't know how they can't be thinking differently today than they are. And I hate to analyze it based on the virus, but it is what it is. And if you're the Wizards, you got up with a different viewpoint on your outlook today, whether you have to feel good about it or not.
Well, if they pick up two games in the first two games, then it's on. If they don't pick up any ground, if it's neutral in those first two games, Washington's last six are Indiana, lots at stake. Philadelphia, lots at stake. New Orleans, lots at stake. Oklahoma City, lots at stake. And then Milwaukee and Boston at the end. Now, it could be better to play those teams at the end because they could be set and not have anything to play for. Brooklyn's last six games, Milwaukee and Boston, they get them right away. Sac, potentially lots at stake. Clippers, we'll see. Orlando, again at the end. And then Portland, which either is going to be eliminated and not care or have a lot to play for at the end. If Brooklyn can hold steady in those first two games and somehow get a split and keep Washington six games back / two games back of play-in eligibility, you would think that they can hold them off. But look, if the Nets go 2-6 in those eight games, which is not unrealistic to me if Dinwiddie doesn't come and they have essentially no point guard on their team, no proven point guard on their team, you know, they'll get by with LeVert, who's decent as a lead ball handler. Tyler Johnson, they just signed, you know, who knows. Washington only has to go 4-4 to force a play-in, and that's feasible to me.
Can I go way not conspiracy, but can I go next level here?
Obviously.
These two teams, Washington and Brooklyn, are kind of lining up for a possible trade. I don't think Washington's ready to trade Bradley Beal, but if they get to that point, Brooklyn is a team that is in the hunt there. And, hey, if you're Brooklyn, I would want to make sure Jared Allen looks pretty damn good against you. And if you play him in a play-in series, feed Jared Allen the ball.
If Dinwiddie comes, between Dinwiddie, Joe Harris, LeVert, Allen, Prince, and Garrett Temple, the Nets have enough. The Nets will, I would be confident that the Nets will hold off Washington and probably not even be engaged in a play-in tournament. If Dinwiddie doesn't come, I think that they're in a little bit of trouble in that regard. But again, the first two games can nullify all that trouble. They still have LeVert. I mean, my guess would be their starting lineup will be LeVert without Dinwiddie. Will be LeVert, Joe Harris, Garrett Temple, Torian Prince, and Jared Allen. That's a real NBA lineup. It's a legitimate. It's not a lineup you'd like to start in real games, but it's a decent NBA lineup. The problem comes with whoever when someone gets substituted, you're down to essentially nobody that you trust.
Well, the other thing is I'm a little bit worried about some of the other players having the virus. Now, we've got two of their players have the virus. I'm sure they're analyzing what to do about their facility. The difficulty with this is you don't know where they got it. But that's really worrisome, and I don't know if any of their other players are going to get worried and if anybody else fails. But, you know, if this is a time that you want – if Brooklyn accomplishes anything – the showcasing of Caris LeVert and Jared Allen, because even if it's not for Bradley Beal, I mean, Kyrie Irving has pretty much come out and shown their cards when he announced that they needed to improve and then announced their core players. Jared Allen wasn't in there.
Nor was Joe Harris. Yeah, he's a very good player who Kyrie Irving should really want to be on his team because he doesn't need the ball and he's one of the best shooters on planet Earth.
For sure. One thing I would say is that if this can, you may say, how could 8 games in Orlando? Guys have gotten giant contracts based on 8 games in the playoffs. So, if you're looking for something to come out of this for Brooklyn, Joe Harris has a lot to play for because he's an unrestricted free agent. Although he's in the same boat kind of as Davis Bertans, he hasn't had the same injury level in his career, but he has had injuries. And so I assume he's going to play, but, he's got some lot on the line, but between Joe Harris, between Caris LeVert, who looked like he came out of the quarantine in great shape, and Jared Allen, you have an opportunity to really showcase your assets because this is like a poorly kept secret that the Nets plan is to try to go out and get a third star, and LeVert and Allen are your two prime pieces in dangling that. And if those guys can not only carry Brooklyn and make sure they make the playoffs, but then actually get a playoff series, it's a great opportunity for them for all those reasons.
Yeah, it's such an interesting storyline. As far back ago as I think September, I wrote a piece about teams that are in position to decide between two stars plus depth, plus like real quality depth, which is what Brooklyn has right now if you include Durant and Irving, right, who are not going to play, and Durant obviously hasn't played all year, versus exchange a lot of that depth for a third star and become super heavy at the top and thin at the bottom. I think that's a fascinating philosophical choice. I wrote about it in September, and I wrote about it directly because the Nets are facing that choice, and I mentioned Beal in that article as the third star that they all face that choice with. People can read it and find what I concluded, but I think it's a really interesting philosophical debate. I agree with you that it will be something that it is something that is potentially actionable if a lot of things flip the right way. Number one of which is Washington has to be willing to trade Bradley Beal, and they have insisted over and over again that they are not. Now teams insist over and over again that they are not willing to trade player X until circumstances demand that or require that they do so. Obviously, John Wall has been seen working out and looking good. I think the Wizards do have an interest in seeing how that group looks next season. So it is interesting. And I love that the Nets have signed Tyler Johnson. We're really just, they need to acquire Otto Porter at some point just to hit the trifecta of all the guys that Sean Marks hit with the poison pill offer sheets and didn't get. Got Crabbe, got Tyler Johnson. We got to get Otto Porter to the Nets just for the sake of NBA trivia.
Yeah, and like I respect the job that Sean Marks has done there. It's been amazing considering what he took over to
incredible.
What they have now.
Incredible.
But those offer sheets were all terrible in the moment. They've all proven to be terrible, and yet he still wants to keep getting these players to remind everybody how terrible those offer sheets were.
Look, when you've got
I respect it. He's sticking by that evaluation.
Look, some people just have their soft spots in life, whether it's a certain food you got to order every time, a bad relationship you stay in because you just can't quit it. You know, if you got a Jones for Allen Crabbe, you got a Jones for Allen Crabbe. There's nothing you can do about it.
I have to say, I really appreciate Tyler Johnson being honest. But the story, it was in ESPN, the magazine. I can't
remember. Pablo Torre wrote it.
God bless him. When he tells the story of Tyler Johnson vomiting when he heard how much money he was signing for.
I've never heard of a joyful vomit. Like a happy vomit.
Yeah. I don't have to say anything more. What else could I possibly say?
A word on Jared Allen. I think Jared Allen is much more important to the Nets' long-term future than DeAndre Jordan. And I have been a little mean to DeAndre Jordan in the last couple of years. I wrote this sometime during the pandemic. It all blends together. In the last probably 2 months of the season, before this, they had suspended the season, DeAndre Jordan legitimately outplayed Jared Allen. He proved me wrong. He proved a lot of the doubters wrong. He was better than Jared Allen. Now, I don't think he was like 20% better than Jared Allen, but he was better, a little bit better. His passing had improved. His turnovers were down. He's still a legitimate threat on the roll. Even when he doesn't move much on defense, he's still a big deterrent, and he's much stronger than Jared Allen. So when you throw him against an Embiid or a Jokic or the rare guys who like to push people around, he's an important part of the Nets. And for all the fun I've poked at DJ in the last couple of years, he had outplayed Jared Allen and was an important part of their team. So this is a big moment for Jared Allen if we actually get to Orlando and have games, which, you know, I'm going to say if. I'm going to continue to say if until they're down there playing games. Anything else on the Nets and the Wizards, or are we ready to leave this behind? And the Magic, I guess. The Magic are in this imbroglio, something like that. Natalie Imbruglia, I don't know, something like that.
The Magic have such a fascinating situation because all of these teams...
I'm going to stop you there. They don't have a fascinating situ8ation. There's nothing fascinating about the Magic.
With the bubble. Because all of their friends and family are there in Orlando. Their temptation is so much greater. You know, it's one thing if you're stuck in the bubble and you play for the LA Clippers, most of your family is in Los Angeles or elsewhere. In Orlando, those people are there. They are down the road. So, you know, the one big concern about the bubble is with all these things, all this rising is, you know, infiltration, you know, and, you know, the Magic have the greatest temptation of all of that. So they have a special challenge. You'd think that it's an advantage to be playing at home, but they're not playing at home. They're playing on the road at home. That's almost the worst scenario.
I apologize for offending the Magic fans. I actually do think the Magic. Actually, my writing would suggest that I have a soft spot for the Magic and their franchise decisions. And obviously, they have Markelle Fultz, who's one of the most interesting players in the NBA. Look, the evidence suggests this: if anybody leaves the bubble. And not just players. Everyone wants to focus on, oh, the player's going to go do this, that, and the other. If anybody leaves the bubble, the risk is enormous. The risk of bringing it back is real and enormous. And, like, if this is going to work, it just has to be highly, highly regulated, and people cannot leave because the risk, particularly with Florida shockingly bungling the coronavirus response, the risk is enormous. And on the flip side, the German Basketball League, on a much smaller scale and over a much shorter period of time, just completed a bubble with no positive tests. And again, it's the German Basketball League, so it was a much more limited number of personnel in a shorter time frame. But it's possible, but this is a much more rickety thing. Let's move on.
Chinese basketball bubble is holding. But they have draconian measures, and no players union, but draconian measures. Basically, you may not leave your hotel room or else, or face who knows what, but it's holding in China. So,
let's talk about the decision, because you wrote a fantastic look back, not just at the decision, but at the 3 days kind of sandwiching the decision with the decision in the middle on ESPN.com. Anyone can find it. It's on the front page. It's been on the front page for a day and a half now. It's a fantastic look back at what is truly a momentous event in the history of sports on almost every possible level. So I want to start here, because we can attack this TV show, and I don't mean attack, criticize. I mean analyze it and talk about it from a number of different angles. But let's start with something that I found the most interesting. I read your book over the summer, LeBron Inc., about the making of a billionaire athlete. And I don't think I had known this. I don't know that you ever said it publicly before in the book. But you said during the show, before LeBron chooses the Heat, as Jim Gray on question number 572, before getting to the real question, is asking LeBron, have you told the teams your decision? You get a text from the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, Dan Gilbert. I just can't, if he could have made the text in Comic Sans, I bet it would have been asking you, Windy. I'm assuming he called you Windy. I hope he did. Windy, he just told us it's Miami. Break the news on Twitter and undercut the show. So undercut the suspense of the show. So I want you to take me back in that moment. You suspected he was going to Miami.
Yeah.
Most of the people in the know suspected he was going to Miami. But I can imagine TV on, I don't know if you're in the office of the plane dealer, wherever you are, I can imagine my hand shaking as I read that text and I have this decision to make about whether I'm going to tweet it or not?
Well, I did tweet it, but, you know, this, first off, you have to realize Twitter was in its pretty significant infancy. I had just started using it during that previous season. Actually, the reaction to the decision was a reminder of how limited social media was at that time, because there had been heavy reports throughout the day on social media that he was going to Miami. Yet, even in Cleveland, where every LeBron James creak in the floor was reported with breathless analysis, apparently the people either didn't know or were in denial because they all act shocked. So I think, you know, Stephen A. Smith, so, you know, we now know that they agreed that they were all going to play in Miami on July 4th, which was a Sunday. The decision,
which you have reported, yeah, there was a phone call on July 4th.
Whether or not we believe that that was the time where they decided to play together, or that was the time when they decided Miami over Chicago or whatever, that I don't know. But it was decided on July 4th. And within a day or two, Stephen A. Smith was the first person to say, and he didn't come out and say they are going to, I don't remember exactly what he said. That was the first place I heard it. Then overnight, the night before the decision, Alan Hahn, who was working for Newsday, reported they're all going to Miami, multiple sources. The best thing that I could get reported during that day was that LeBron had told people he was going to Miami. So I had one removed. But there was a story on the Plain Dealers website, and I had tweeted it. But still, it just wasn't out there. And, you know, and during, as the day went along, I did think there was a possibility that he could have a change of heart. I had limited sources in Miami, but the sources that I had in Miami were telling me that they had been told nothing, which was true. Even though LeBron had told Wade, which was a pipeline, the Heat certainly knew. They just didn't know if it was official. They had already lined up a sign and trade for Bosch. Bosch and Wade had announced the day before. So they did the sign and trade for Bosch, and they're getting ready to line up a sign and trade for LeBron. They're getting ready to line up, dumping Michael Beasley to afford all of this. So the show comes on about 9 o'clock, and even on the show, even though there's heavy reporting, and certainly Michael Wilbon and Chris Broussard have talked to people, Michael Wilbon was talking to Dwayne Wade on the phone during this process. He certainly was aware of some stuff going on. They hedged a little bit. So we all kind of thought it was Miami, but we hedged because we couldn't say for 100% certain. And then about 9:20, I actually went back and looked. So he made the statement at 9:28 Eastern, and I tweeted at about 9:26 that the teams had been told. And I tweeted that after Dan Gilbert had texted me. And Dan Gilbert,
did you say that the teams had been told it was Miami?
Yes, the teams had been told he's going to Miami. But look,
so you did tweet it.
I had 2 minutes, Zach. I had 30,000 Twitter followers at the time. I had 17,000 at the beginning of that week. My Twitter following doubled because, wow, I was tweeting like all the details of the meetings, who was coming and going and stuff. Twitter was so much in its infancy. And even today, if this was happening today, even if Woj tweeted something with millions of followers, or I have 700,000 or whatever, even 2 minutes, I'm not sure it makes a difference. So the text, the way you described the text didn't include the edge and profanity that was in it. I had elected not to go to Greenwich because I thought it would be pointless, because I would have not been able to get in. I would have been outside. So I was just at home when it happened. More people knew because he had a hotel reservation that night at the W in South Beach. They didn't just show up at the door and say, "Hey, give me your finest suite." And you actually wrote one of the most definitive pieces about the decision when you were at Sports Illustrated. And you're going to have to tell people about it, Zach, because unfortunately with the things at Sports Illustrated, it's no longer, you have to like go into the archive.
It's dead. It's gone. It's gone.
And when I wrote the book, about, you know, LeBron's business, LeBron Inc., that I'm going to tell you that was the most definitive piece. Was written, what, 1 year after? That was the most definitive piece that had been done on the decision that now is dead.
I think you're blowing it up a little bit, which I appreciate, but I only talked to like five people who were involved in the decision at that point, and I didn't have any relationship with LeBron's people. I mean, I was 1 year into covering the NBA, and I just happened by some connections to have an in with one person who is involved in the making of the show, and that's someone who worked at the Boys and Girls Club in Greenwich where he filmed it. And that person connected me to the person whose house he had been at, LeBron had been at before in the hours leading up to the show, and he connected me to the guy who organized the flight path for the private jet. So we kind of got into the machinations of the hours, but in terms of the basketball part, I had nothing in there about that. But yeah, that was a fun story, and yes, thank you. It's now dead. The link is now dead, but I just that getting that text from Dan Gilbert, I could picture my hands shaking. I'm glad to hear that it was profane, and obviously he now, then writes this ridiculous letter in the aftermath of the decision, which to me, even then, in the midst of people burning LeBron's jersey, everyone in the media, and I mean almost everyone, ripping this as self-serving, hubristic, an awful hour of television, blah, blah, blah. And by the way, I'm not exempt from it. I would say that looking back, I was a mild critic of the show. It didn't really offend me on some sort of basic visceral level, but I thought it was a little clumsy, let's say, and definitely mean to Cleveland, but it was going to be mean to Cleveland no matter what. It never really super duper bothered me, but even when that letter came out, I remember thinking, this kind of validates LeBron's decision to leave. Like, if this is your reaction to this, it's a pretty big window into your personality and your relationship with LeBron, and like that, this kind of seals the deal. Like, this is a decision that, like, I get it more now.
Yeah. So there were three things happened all in a row, and that's why you got to be careful throwing stones here. The decision itself, which the concept, I still think, has aged beautifully. The idea is a very worthwhile idea, even though I say that in the fact that what LeBron was doing was cutting out the media to a certain extent. That was poorly executed. Then the letter, which was kind of the worst kind of long-term business decision, although it ends up not really – They still, in all miracles, it doesn't ruin the relationship forever because he comes back.
It's incredibly that they reconciled. They didn't reconcile. It's incredible and a testament to, I think, LeBron and his power and his ownership of his story that he decided to go back to Cleveland despite that. And we can talk about it later, but I think that move in 2014 and the decision in 2010 are very much cousins in the sense that they signal a man in 2010, I don't think he was sort of at ease with his own power and strength as he was in 2014, just because he was 25 years old. But they are cousins in that they signal a man who understands how powerful he is and is willing to take absolute complete control of his career.
So we have the decision, the letter, and then the rally, all sort of three in a row. And, like, you know, the Miami Heat are not only known for being really stable, smart, fiscally responsible, strategically advanced team, but they're not the type of organization that normally says, look at us. And yet, even in that moment, they lost sense of themselves. So it was just a time where the emotions and the stakes were so high that even the Miami Heat, who never make faux pas like this, made this massive faux pas in the way they decided to do that. And so it was just a wild 36 hours. And you know, the crazy thing is, and this is still on YouTube, if you go back and look at when Bosch and Wade made their announcement, it was on the noon Sports Center. It was a Wednesday, July 7th, on the noon Sports Center. 12:01, Michael Wilbon comes on. Wade's in a box. Bosch is in a box, and Wilbon's in a box. And in 4 minutes and 55 seconds, Wilbon executes the interview. Says, "Where are you going?" Asks Wade, "Why not Chicago?" Because, you know, Wilbon's a Chicago guy. Talks to Bosch, gets his reasoning for Toronto, and in 5 minutes they put a bow on it. It was beautifully executed and said. And so while I appreciate that what LeBron did, and in many ways, it was like the first step towards his media operation, and that first step had to happen for them to go where they are today, where, you know, just, you know, literally 10 years later, they have $100 million, investment in their production company they just announced last week. The handling of that by professionals, by the Sports Center operation and by Michael Wilbon versus the amateurs was incredible. And I say that being an ESPN employee, I realize that I can't step totally out of that, but seeing how those two were done, if you just went and watched how Wilbon did it, like, that's how it's supposed to be done. It was done perfectly. Well, you never hear any complaining about that.
Well, let's just get that part of the discussion over with now. You put it correctly, cutting the media out, except for ESPN, which broadcast the event. They cut the media out. I think it's undeniable that it was clumsy. LeBron was nervous. It took too long. It was just not well put together from just an aesthetic sense. Sometimes I actually wonder if LeBron had just worn a different shirt, if it would have been received like 20%. There's something about that shirt, and I have many shirts that are similar to it, probably less expensive. I don't know why. It's if he just had worn a plain like blue shirt, I think like the vitriol would have gone down by like 20%. It's not a bad shirt. It's a nice shirt. I would wear that shirt. There's something about it. I don't know why. But I think I admired him cutting out the media then, and I admire it even more now, because it was a statement that said, if all you can bring to the table is a recording device, I don't need that. I can construct my own recording devices, which has become Uninterrupted and Spring Hill Entertainment and all of the billion-dollar businesses that LeBron has built, or combined billion dollars. It put pressure on media, and the Players Tribune did as well. And all of this stuff about athletes cutting out the media, I don't view it as cutting out. I think it puts pressure on the media. And the good of it is it puts pressure on the media to bring more than stenography. If all you can do is be a stenographer and all you can do is offer me a platform, I can do that on my own. I don't need you. And readers don't need you either. You've got to be able to bring more than that. The downside is, and Don Van Natta hinted at this in his wonderful backstory piece that ran on ESPN on Sunday. The downside is, I do think the decision was part of, and probably the most important event in athletes in realizing how much power they have. I do think there has been some rise in sort of access journalism in the NBA, in terms of like some athletes know that we have so much power. If we're going to give you any access, if we're going to give you a 1-hour interview, if we're going to give you whatever, we're going to have some sort of authority over shaping the story that you write. And I don't think that's universal. I don't think that's anything like an endemic, but or even necessarily totally. I think it's mostly bad, but I think there's been a rise in that since the decision. Then that's the cost. And if that's the cost, then I think you just have to pay that cost and find a way to make everyone's content better.
Yeah, well, look, at the end of the day, that's true. But that's an inherent thing that happens in all media. When somebody comes on
all media, celebrity media, right, everything.
When when Ben Affleck comes on the Tonight Show, yes, he's Ben Affleck and he draws in viewers, and the deal is I come and I will, you know, sit in here and joke with Jimmy Fallon for 6 minutes, but you also promote my movie. That's existed for decades, will exist for decades more. There's an inherent deal that works together. Where the decision was a problem was the arrogance that they had and that they could do it better, that they didn't have a writer. You know, and you notice, you know, I'm Taking My Talents to South Beach was a horribly written line. I don't know who came up with it. I don't know if it was LeBron himself. I know it was a reference to what Kobe said. But any writer could have sat with him and said, don't do it this way. Which is why when he made his announcement going back to Cleveland, what did he do? He partnered with one of the best sports writers in the country, in Lee Jenkins. And Lee Jenkins crafted it because he realized how it helps to have a professional writer. They didn't do prep. I mean, you know, if LeBron was going to play a playoff game in front of 10 million people, which is what the decision was, he would prepare, his preparation would be very intense because, yes, basketball is different than making television, but it requires preparation. LeBron is willy-nilly, you know, spends the afternoon hanging out with Kanye West, which is an incredible aspect of this. Kanye shows up at this guy's house while LeBron's getting ready for this. He shows up a half hour before the show. Would he show up a half hour before before a playoff game in front of 10 million people? No. I mean, I know it's not the same. He doesn't need a stretch or whatever. But it was there was a lack of respect to actually what he was doing. That's why I'm saying, if you watch what Wilbon does, Wilbon had been interviewing people for 30 years, had been making television for a decade. If you watch how Wilbon handles it and you watch how they handle it 24 hours later, if they had just let Wilbon do it, I'm not talking about, you know, Jim Gray, but they were so focused on that they could take it from ESPN and say, this is ours. That they lost the idea that maybe whether they should do that. And so even now, LeBron has all these projects. He's got dozens of projects. He's not directing any of them. He's acting in almost none of them. He's not writing them. He's executive producer, which means he's sort of reviewing them and nodding them, but he's taking a very small thing in it. And, you know, that's the thing. Yes, athletes can take control of their own announcements and take control of their own content, but they are great at being athletes. They are not great at the content part of it. And that was the biggest lesson. And if you look now at what LeBron does, and a month or so ago, he and his group produced this special for graduating seniors that was on all three networks. It was beautifully produced. It was beautifully written, had great musical performances, had a speech from President Obama, who's one of the great orators of our time. No matter what your politics are, you cannot deny the man can give a great speech. He got that. And then when LeBron spoke on it, it was this beautifully designed, written, and performed on tape speech that he made. That was their doctorate compared to the first day of high school, which is essentially what the decision was. Unfortunately, the first day of high school in their media production careers was watched by 10 million people. And so at the end of the day, that's what it was. And once you get your mind around that and you understand it, I think you can feel a lot better. But for so many people, they saw it and they lowered the door on LeBron and said, that's ridiculous, you're a fool, when the actuality was there were so many more layers than that.
Yeah, I thought it was clumsy and sloppy, but it never offended me. I was never offended by it. I never held it against them. I was never that – it's kind of – typically me, I didn't have a particularly strong take. And I will also say, and I've said this privately to many friends, and I've maybe said it publicly before, I am one of – unknown amount of media members who got hired because of the decision. I owe my job in the NBA to the decision, because when the decision happened, it was such an event. And it, not just the decision, but LeBron's free agency in general was such an event that almost every publication covering sports realized in that moment, we do not have enough people covering the NBA. We need more resources covering the NBA. And lots of people who were freelancing, trying to make it part-time, not involved in the NBA at all, lots of people got hired because of that, of how momentous the decision was.
Yeah, this is one thing that, you know, at times over his career, LeBron has been criticized for being hard on coaches and, you know, getting coaches fired or whatever. But when LeBron comes into your ocean, all the ships rise, right? So over the course of LeBron's career, he has gotten so many teammates, coaches, support staff, definitely media. He has risen the ocean for all of us. All of us have had the ocean rise because of LeBron. And that doesn't mean that he should not be criticized for making a mistake, but we have all benefited from it. The league in general has benefited from it. I don't know if you could assign a dollar figure to the league, but it's in the billions. And so he, without question, his willingness and his ability and his charisma and the fact that so many people are interested in him have done this. And the fact that 10 years later, even with all the success that he's had the last 10 years, people still are so thinking and talking about this, just shows how influential of a person that he has become.
Which is interesting, because I think in the last 3 or 4 years, LeBron's social activism has really elevated, but he's done more, right? He opened a school. I mean, he opened a freaking school. Can you imagine that? The guy opened a school that's going to serve thousands of kids from Akron and the surrounding area. He's been more active in politics. He just started More Than a Vote, which is tackling one of the most pressing issues in the United States. Before the last 4 years, I didn't find LeBron like as a human being. I don't remember like ever. I just don't think that there was the interest in him didn't match to me what his persona was. Like his persona was almost a little bit dry because I think he was so protective of his image, and now it's become the opposite. He's fascinating, and I would read a lot of stuff about him, but I never found him as just compelling as Jordan or Barkley or lots of guys who have come before him, lots of stars who have come before him until the last 4 or 5 years. That said, I think the decision and the criticism he took in the wake of it, becoming a villain. I mean, he was hated. He was one of the most, he was hated by huge segments. People were rooting against the Heat in the 2011 finals to see LeBron lose. I think that has actually now zooming out 10 years later, I think that's made his career arc so much more interesting because he had to navigate that and he had trouble. He's admitted he had trouble navigating being the villain. He had to come out the other side, win championships with Miami under enormous pressure because that thing came close to teetering multiple seasons in terms of just how close they got to not winning. And then have the wherewithal to say, you know what? I've done what I came to Miami to do. I know my falling out with Cleveland was terrible. I'm going back anyway, and I'm going to win. And he won. And I just think his career arc, almost by accident because of how much dislike he took from the decision, is more interesting, and he's more human, and he's more relatable because of it.
He's talked about this. He, for a long time, was really focused on what people thought of him, which is common for many people when they're young. Becoming self-actualized is a struggle that into adulthood that everyone to a certain extent has. And basically he got to the point where he was like, I now, because I realized I tried to make everybody happy and I failed, I'm now not going to worry about making everybody happy anymore. And that freed him in so many different ways. It freed him on the court. You know, he went through that finals with Dallas, reading all of the columns. Like he would spend his off days during that Dallas series reading all of the columns, about how he was struggling and failing. And by the way, this wasn't like something that I was whispered to. He flat out told me that he was reading all the columns. And so, to get to the point where he was like, I don't care what any of you say. I don't care what anybody thinks of me. I don't care about any of that. I'm going to be myself. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go back to Cleveland. I'm going to then go to Los Angeles. I'm going to create this media company. I'm going to be political. I'm going to say what I say. That, you know, maybe that would have happened anyway, but it took that year of misery that he basically had, because he was miserable his first year in Miami. So miserable that he basically went back to Ohio and just stayed there. You know, the lockout's going on. The snow is falling in Ohio. His house in Miami is in 75 degree weather. He's in Ohio playing flag football because he was so scarred by that first year. Getting through that changed his personality to an extent, and he's benefited from it immensely, not just from a competition standpoint, but not being afraid to put himself out there for other things, including social justice, which now is becoming something that everyone is being encouraged to do. But when he was starting to do it, it wasn't seen that way.
I guess what I was inartfully trying to say before is that pre-decision, the most compelling thing about LeBron to me, and maybe this is my fault because I hadn't delved as deeply into his background and where he had come from and all of that, the most compelling thing to me was just how talented he was as a basketball player. And I could see that. That's there for everybody to see. It's incredibly compelling. That began to the rest of LeBron became more matched his talent in terms of how compelling and interesting he was because of the decision and starting and going from there. That's all I was trying to say. Let's talk about Cleveland and Plan Bs. So Cleveland is obviously devastated that he leaves. take me back. What exactly can the Cavs offer LeBron? Because they had a minimal amount of cap space. They had Mo Williams was 27, Anderson Varejao was 27, Delonte West was 26, J.J. Hickson was 21. They made noise about, well, can we engage the Raptors in a sign and trade for Bosch? And Bosch, as you wrote, had no interest in coming to Cleveland. So when you look back on it, it's really not – like the Cavs didn't have other than, hey, we've won 60 games 2 years in a row and failed in the playoffs. They didn't have like that compelling of a case unless I'm missing something, right?
That's true. You know, the thing about it was, unlike – the Cavs were unlike the other teams in that they were trying to, like, heck, to win the title the previous 2 years. Those other teams were in the middle of rebuilds. I mean, 2 years prior, the Bulls had the number one overall pick. The Nets, who had multiple max slots, had won, I think, 12 games the year before. The Knicks had ripped their team down. The Cavs were trying to compete. Now, you can argue and say, well, you know, trading for, you know, 34-year-old Ben Wallace and 38-year-old Shaquille O'Neal, whatever, 33, 34-year-old Antoine Jameson, that's not the way to do it. And I wouldn't disagree with that. But they were trying to do the best they could. And so they were ill-equipped. And so when you look back at it as the final analysis, I mean, Miami was sitting there with saying, we can do all three of you together in Miami. Chicago was saying we can do two of you plus this other really good young team that we have. And everybody else was can argue whether they were in third place. And that's just the reality of it. And so yes, the Raptors knew that Bosch was gone. I'm not even sure that the Raptors even pitched Bosch. I didn't even go down that road.
Can I read you a Dwayne Wade quote about that?
Yeah.
This is Dwayne Wade upon getting acquired by upon signing with the Bulls. He starts to open up about, the 2010 process. He signs with the Bulls, I believe, in 2016. This is from a Sam Smith piece. Miami came with the idea that they can get three players. We never thought it was possible. Okay, maybe. That was my editorial. I was shocked when I heard it could happen, but I know LeBron's eyes were here in Chicago. I know my eyes were here. I know Chris's eyes were kind of everywhere because he was in Toronto, so he was just happy that people knew who he was. Wow, Dwayne Wade, coming at the city of Toronto and the Raptors organization hard.
Man, well, I mean, one of the most amazing things that I sort of learned about this that I'd never heard was that, and maybe this has been reported elsewhere, I just didn't remember it, but when I talked to people with the Bulls, they said that they pitched Wade first. Their first meeting was with Wade at the United Center. And they didn't give him their whole pitch. And they didn't give them their whole pitch because they were so convinced he was re-signing with Miami. And Miami was a competitor for all of these players that they didn't want Dwayne coming back to the Heat and saying, hey, here's what the Bulls told me. This is what they're going to tell LeBron. Now you counteract it. So the Bulls don't give the full pitch. And the next day, Wade asks for a second meeting. And at that meeting, the Bulls figure out, oh my God, he's actually maybe serious about coming here, and they give him the full pitch. But the irony is, when Wade comes to the meeting, he says, hey, I've just met with the Heat. Is there a way you could create room for a third player, a third star? And so he brought the Heat's plan to the Bulls. The Bulls were worried about having it leaked to the Heat, and they end up getting it. And so to me, I know that there are people in this league, and I've heard them, who go, don't be snookered. They're always going to Miami. Don't listen to this crap about the Bulls. It's just a obfuscation to make it think like it wasn't a done deal. You're naive if you believe that. I don't believe that. I believe that when Wade asked for that second meeting and asked the Bulls if there was a way that they could get a third slot after he heard that pitch from – because he went immediately from the United Center to Henry Thomas, the late Henry Thomas, who was the agent of Bosch and Wade – a fine man, honorable man, went to his office. Riley gives Wade the three-prong pitch. They had been doing all these little moves leading up to it, buying James Jones out and trading DaQuan Cook, and they were just slowly moving there. He hears it and goes right back to the Bulls. He doesn't go back to the Bulls and ask them to clear a third spot if he's not at least somewhat interested. Is he 29% interested? Is he 41% interested? That, you know, only Dwayne can answer that. And my whole thing is, looking back on it, the Bulls had never thought of this. The Bulls all along were like, we've got Derrick Rose, we've got Joakim Noah, we've got Taj Gibson, we've got Luol Deng. We're gonna add another two stars here. That's our move. When the Bulls heard three, it blew them out of the water. They, like, now we all know big three, big three, big three, of course. But back then, Zach, on July 1st, people weren't thinking anybody could do it. And so,
well, and to fit three stars, I mean, you have to tear it to the studs.
They had one player in the contract.
Well, and they all ended up having to take pay cuts to fit Mike Miller and Udonis Haslam. You have to rip it to the studs. And the Bulls, you went through it. You know, you can sign and trade the Luol Deng for nothing in salary to try it, but you still have Rose and Noah and Gibson, and you're probably still going to fall short of the salaries those guys wanted. To me, when I read all the coverage, including yours, about Chicago, and I've read lots of other coverage plus yours, which is the best, my take on Chicago is they would have been thrilled to get two. And I think in alternate universes, but the two were always going to be Bosch plus LeBron, Bosch plus Wade, thrilled. And I think in a lot of alternate universes, that's a situation that's very appealing to Bosch, Wade, Bosch, LeBron. But what was unavoidable for the Bulls was Wade and LeBron wanted to play together. And they didn't, I don't think they were, I think they had concerns about playing together with Derrick Rose because it was just going to be too much ball handling, too little shooting. And so in a theoretical world where the Bulls cut Bosch out and say, well, okay, we can get two stars. How about you guys? I think based on what I've read, this is just based on what I've read in the reporting, I think they would have said, well, we'd like this other situation better. So I'm not sure what really the Bulls could have done in the end to offer them a situation that was as compelling to them as Miami. Does that make any sense to you?
Clearly. I can sum it up in one sentence. Three is greater than two. And at the time, Derrick Rose should have been included as one of a big three, but he wasn't, for better or worse. I mean, he won the MVP the next year. Three was greater than two. Now, Riley had a singular obsession and focus to clear it, to make it happen. He was driving at it with an unstoppable force, with a cap expert who had every tool in the toolbox doing it. The Bulls did not have the same motivation. They did not have the same motivation to dump this team that they were making to try to have this happen. And by the way, I'm not criticizing them for that because they, even without LeBron, Wade, or Bosch, they won 60 games the next year and went 3-0 against the Heat in the regular season. And arguably, had you given them a little bit more time and they had, you know, given them another transaction cycle before Rose blows out his knee, maybe they have a ring and they have no regrets.
I'm glad you brought that up because I'm going to write a piece in the next week or two about, and I podcast with Lebitard about this in January, about the legacy of that Heat team. And I think really when you talk about it, and I don't want to get sidetracked, but a lot of it comes down to two knees, or maybe three knees, Derrick Rose's knee and Dwayne Wade's knees. On the one hand, Derrick Rose's knee eliminated what stood to be as their true rival, their true test, in a way that I don't think Indiana, as well as they played them in the playoffs, was ever equipped to be. And then Wade's knees, I think, cut them short in terms of their longevity. But that's a different story. By the way, about Cleveland, you've written about this. I don't know what amount of money I would pay to see it, but it's not a trivial sum. The Cavs, in their presentation to LeBron, I guess commissioned Seth MacFarlane and the creators of Family Guy.
No, they tried to get Seth MacFarlane to do it. He was too busy. Okay. So they had a Family Guy style, like a knockoff.
So they showed LeBron, who's a Family Guy fan. Now what I'm learning from you is a knockoff Family Guy that includes the characters of Family Guy making jokes at the expense of the other teams that were trying to get LeBron. Oh my God, would I pay money to see that and see what jokes they made about the other teams that were trying to get LeBron, how crude they were, how they might have gone over in that room. If in watching them, I would have been like in LeBron's shoes, if I would have been like, oh my God, I would have done the Homer Simpson back through the shrubbery to get out of the room if they were there. I would just love to see it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, remember, this is Dan Gilbert's brainchild, and Dan, you know, there was nobody precious to him. And the reason it's probably never come out is because it would probably really make some people look bad because I think it targeted.
We need to drop everything. Forget the bubble. We need to put all our reporting resources at ESPN into getting that tape. We need to get that tape among other tapes that the world needs to see. We need to get that tape.
Yeah. So, and you know, according to people there, LeBron was roaring with laughter. And I'm sure he did enjoy it. Apparently had inside jokes. It mocked the executives and the players on the other teams.
Oh my God.
Which is probably one of the reasons why we've never heard about it, because it's just probably really not something that they want to be associated with. But I will say this, they did know his style of humor. We know you. This is, you know, their pitch to him was not, hey, we're going to get Wade and Bosch. Their pitch was, we know you. This is your home. And
JJ Hickson's going to be an all-star.
They didn't realize. And the thing about it is, like, they had worked out they had called the Raptors. I wouldn't say it was worked out, but they had called the Raptors and said, hey, if Bosch wants to come here, can we do a deal? And, you know, Brian Colangelo and the Raptors long wanted Anderson Varejao. There would have had to have been other pieces in the deal. Maybe Hickson would have been in that deal. Delonte West had a non-guaranteed contract, so he could have been involved in it and they could have cut him. But they could have gotten there with Varejao and potentially draft pick asset or two as a deal. So they knew that they could get Bosch, but they could not – they literally could not get Henry Thomas, Bosch's agent, to return their call. And forget about even set up a meeting. They couldn't get a call back. So when they came to LeBron, when it came to improving the team, they said, listen – we can trade for Bosch, but we really need your assistance in recruiting him. And LeBron basically said to them secondhand, he didn't say it to me, was, hey, I don't know what Chris Bosch is doing. It's not what I do. And you know what? That obviously wasn't 100% true, because literally the next day he was agreeing to go play with Bosch. But it also shouldn't be LeBron's burden to put the team together. You know, so I don't blame LeBron for taking that position, quite frankly. But at the same time, I'm not sitting here. I mean, the Cavs made their mistakes, but it wasn't like they made their mistakes and had a 30-win team. They had two 60-win teams.
It would be interesting to trace back and see what missed opportunities were there for the Cavs to give LeBron more confidence in their long-term future. I haven't done that in recent months, so I'm not going to speak to that now. It does raise an interesting question, though, because you quote David Fizdale, who is a Heat assistant, in your story, that even if Dwayne knew on July 8th when LeBron announces it, there's still some trepidation within the Heat that they know, but they don't really know. There's still some nervousness about, is he actually going to say the words Miami Heat or South Beach or whatever on television? Which brings me to my next question, which is, what's plan B for Chris Bosch if this doesn't happen, if LeBron decides he's going to stay in Cleveland, if somehow it doesn't work out? And I guess, is it just self-evident that plan B is Wade and Bosch are going to Miami without LeBron?
Or if Wade and LeBron play together.
Or Chicago.
I think Bosch goes to Chicago or Miami. I think, you know, the story goes that Bosch, in his meeting with the Bulls, led the Bulls to believe he was really seriously interested in playing there. And one of the reasons why there was so much animosity from the Bulls toward the Heat is they feel like Bosch may have led them down the path. But, you know, I wasn't there. I didn't hear what was said. I don't know if one person said something that they wanted to hear or what have you. But Bosch had great options. And, you know, I interviewed Chris for this piece. And, you know, Chris was like, I was just so excited. You know, he goes, what happened to us during that rally was – we were just so excited. I just signed a $110 million contract. I was going to live in Miami. We were going to play together. We were going to win championships. I was just really excited. Chris really went into this more doe-eyed and about the experience than LeBron or Wade, who are more strategic and worried about their legacies or whatever. Chris is just wired a little bit differently. So I think Chris would have been happy no matter what. And I think no matter what, he was leaving Toronto, and there were hard feelings there, but I don't think he regrets any of that. I think the real fallout here is the concept of the big three. Even though Wade did the recruiting, ultimately Wade had to reel them in. He reeled in Bosch and he reeled in LeBron. It was Pat Riley's big thinking that made this happen. And he was aided by the fact that it was in Miami, and he was aided by the fact that he had Wade, and he was aided by the fact that there's no state income tax, so that if they all took a little bit of a pay cut, they actually could make it back on that. all that helped him. He was aided by Andy Ellisberg, who made it all possible. But Pat Riley's big thinking made this possible. And the other players and teams didn't think that big. And that's why Riley, the marriage of Riley, Wade, Miami, and all that stuff is why this happened. You take out any one of those components and things could have gone differently.
Can I ask you a couple more quick questions about the decision?
Yeah.
In LeBron Inc., which is your best-selling book about LeBron James, I assume it's a bestseller. I didn't fact-check that.
Thank you for asking. It did make the bestseller list.
There you go. You have another what if in there, which maybe is so far-fetched it's not really worth this much discussion, but I wanted to discuss it anyway, which was the Clippers. And you raise in the book that Maverick Carter had, I believe it was Maverick Carter, struck up a relationship with David Geffen, the famed music executive, and said, you know, hey, LeBron's not adverse to going to the Clippers, but he doesn't want to play for Donald Sterling. Right. So, like, what about you buy the team from Donald Sterling and LeBron signs with the Clippers? How about that? Was that the extent of it? I mean, who knows if they could have fit all three or something? But I had not remembered that or had never read that before reading your book. And I remember exactly where I was, being like, "Oh my God, that's really interesting."
Yeah. So I mean, Maverick Carter, David Geffen is one of Maverick Carter's idols. Maverick Carter being a media executive. I can't remember the book that was done on David Geffen. Actually, it's an interesting book because Geffen initially started cooperating with it, and then midway through the process of books, he disavowed the book, but it ended up being this incredible book about David Geffen. And of course, now I can't remember what it's called. But Maverick has it. I've seen it in Maverick's office on his shelf. It's a very important book for him. And so, him starting a relationship with Geffen, I mean, he sought him for advice. He respects David Geffen immensely. And, yes, there was a discussion with David Geffen. Hey, could you go? Cause, you know, you needed a billionaire who could say, I want to close the Clippers deal very quickly here. And I don't know how he approached Sterling. I don't know if it was like, let me buy part of the team or buy it later. But you want to talk about power? Getting an hour on ESPN for free, that's pretty big power. How about David Geffen trying to buy the Clippers so that he could get into business with them? That right there is an affirmation of power. And, I know that in Don Van Natta's backstory on it was on ABC the other night that he explored the idea that someone who wrote into Bill Simmons' mailbag actually came up with the idea of the decision. But the real decision was launched at a finals game between the Lakers and Celtics. Where Ari Emanuel, Jim Gray, and Maverick Carter got together and sort of hashed it out during halftime. And Ari Emanuel at WME, William Morris Endeavor, actually put it together, which is interesting because LeBron's agency was CAA, and William Morris Endeavor and CAA are big-time rivals. That's another aspect of it. But, yes, Maverick was in Los Angeles for a time leading up to that. Because, remember, the Cavs get eliminated the first week of May. We now have 7 weeks or so, or maybe the second week of May, 6 or 7 weeks for them to look at their plans. But one of the things was in there. And so Geffen makes some approach to Sterling. Sterling, like he told everybody for decades before and for years after, no, and they had to take it from his cold hands to get it from him anyway. But yeah, I mean, you want to talk about a what if? How about LeBron? How about the Clippers being David Geffen's team and LeBron going there in 2010 with, I'd like to point out, with Blake Griffin sitting there on the roster, and they traded for Chris Paul a year later with assets that they theoretically still would have had, you know, so that's an ultimate what if for sure.
Question number two, you mentioned this in some of your reporting recently. What do you make of this? Because it's one of these all time little things that it pops up in the reporting on the decision, but it's not blown up. So the story is in 2009, I think in Cleveland, maybe it was, you have to tell me where it is. Pat Riley orchestrates a meeting with LeBron James and Michael Jordan to talk about, among other things, Michael Jordan's importance to the legacy of the game and maybe that every team should retire Michael Jordan's number. And this was, I believe, in the Cavs case that there might have been tampering here, this was evidence A. Like, in 2009, when LeBron is a member of the Cavs, he's somehow meeting with Pat Riley and Michael Jordan to talk hoops, I guess. What? Tell me more about that.
The Heat have emphatically denied that this took place.
They've denied it even happened.
The Heat have emphatically denied this took place. But there was a game in Miami that Michael Jordan, before he bought the Charlotte Bobcats, attended with Pat Riley as a guest of Pat Riley. And the Heat had, and still to this day, the Heat retired Michael Jordan's number. Up in the rafters in Miami is Jordan 23. You cannot wear number 23 for the Miami Heat, which is one of the reasons why LeBron wore 6. LeBron was already going to change his number to 6. So before this game, Riley and Jordan talked to LeBron, and I think it's a very casual conversation. I don't think it's like, oh, it's in a vault and we're going to – but during the conversation, the way it's told to me, Riley talks about, you know, we've retired Michael's number here, you know, blah, blah, blah. That night, by the way, LeBron has almost never won in Miami unless he's a member of the Heat. And they actually have a rare win in Miami. And after the game, LeBron basically says, I'm changing my number. We should retire the number of Jordan in every place in this country. And he was so wound up about it that I remember that I like queried him. I was like, no, wait a minute, LeBron. Are you actually saying that everybody should retire this number like Jackie Robinson? And he's like, yes. And like, I even like went over with him a couple of times. He was very fired up about it. And it wasn't that Pat Riley did any sort of tampering. It was that he could show LeBron how they've honored Jordan and that LeBron would respond to that so dramatically. The fact that he gave up his number, and he actually had done the paperwork to change to number 6 for the following year. Even if he had stayed in Cleveland, he would have been number 6. And so it was more about that emboldening Riley to say, I will be able to reach him when it matters. If us honoring Jordan at a game and having him at a game fired up LeBron that much, I think I may be able to reach this guy. And, you know, I don't know how much of what Pat Riley said in that meeting with the rings sold LeBron, or if it was Wade, or if it was the Miami Sun or whatever. But there's no question that Riley is a charismatic individual. In conversations I've had with Pat, or I've watched Pat, you know, give speeches, he's an incredibly charismatic person. And so I have no doubt that his speaking about the importance of Jordan, you know, was emphatic, and it got LeBron to do that. So that's that story. I honestly don't think that there was any legitimate tampering that was done. And not only that, the Cavs traded LeBron to the Heat. They had no claim to any sort of tampering once they did that.
Last question. What's your flashbulb memory? What will you tell your son when he asks you in X amount of years about what it was like to be in Cleveland when LeBron came back for the first time as a member of the Heat? Where were you sitting? What's the image? What's the noise? What's the thing that pops into your head?
I've said this before, the heaviness of the air in the room. I've never felt it before. I mean, I kind of think people don't like, because there's been other times where people have gone back and they're like, oh my gosh, that the venom was there was just as bad as the Heat. And I was like, you know, okay, I wasn't there, so I can't say, but the air felt different. The air felt heavy. And I'm not this type of person, but I'll just say what I felt. The air, you could feel the hate. You could feel the heaviness in the air. And I don't know, I can still remember walking out. We were no longer sitting on the floor by then. We were sitting in the mid deck, and I remember walking out, you know, normally you walk out 3 or 4 minutes before a game, you know, a third of the seats are still unfilled. You know, there's not a lot of focus. Of course, every seat was filled. It felt like you were walking in the middle of the fourth quarter. Maybe that was part of what I felt, was I walked into a room that had intensity in it at a time and a night when you're used to sort of seeing people are watching the scoreboard, people are eating hot dogs, people are chatting, and it was just totally different. Maybe that's what I felt. But LeBron played brilliantly that night under immense pressure. it was a huge moment for the Heat. I mean, I've almost never seen, I think they went 17-1 after that, or 20. I think they went on a stretch where they went 22-1, and that was the start of it. The Cavs went on a 26 game losing streak after that. It empowered one team and broke the other. Regardless of what anybody wants to say about Durant going back to Oklahoma City or whatever else, it didn't affect the two teams like what happened that night did. The air was heavy with hate.
I wasn't at that game. Everyone who I know who was at that game says they have never been at a game like it and probably will never be at a game like it again. I had forgotten last detail. I had forgotten that he did the chalk toss at that game. I admire his courage. I might have bagged that one that night. I forgot that he did that. It was a big deal that he did. It was like Willie or Wonnie, and he did.
And then coming over and talking to the Cavs bench put them in an impossible position. And you know, the crazy thing is he comes back to Cleveland after the lockout, you know, a little over a year later. And the Heat have an off day in Cleveland. They have a practice, and they practice at the practice court. And LeBron says at the practice court, "Yeah, I haven't ruled out coming back here," almost without being asked. And I remember, like, almost like somebody pushed me back. I was like, "What did he just say?" And that was the moment I knew LeBron was going to come back to Cleveland, because he had spent a year in Miami. He'd come back and spent the whole lockout back at home in Akron. He hadn't won a championship yet, but when he said back in that same building where he had all of that hate, "Yeah, I haven't ruled out coming back," that's when I knew he was going to come back. I knew by January or February 2012, LeBron, I didn't know it was going to be 2014, but I knew he was coming back. So the incredible up and back, and the Cavs fans could start tasting it when that fan comes out on the court saying,
"That's right.
Come back, LeBron 2014. And he hugs him. I mean, the Heat have one of the best security guys in the league, David Holcomb. I would never mess with this man. He looks like, a brick house. This guy comes out on the court. Holcomb is scrambling. Holcomb's on top of the kid in 2.3 seconds. And LeBron is hugging him. I mean, like, these are amazing. This all happened in the same building. It was an incredible series of events that happened in those years.
Well, he came back, he won a championship that's an all-time championship, and now plays for the Los Angeles Lakers, which remarkably has not come up in this entire podcast, and has made and will continue to make his case as the greatest player of all time. Wendy, thanks for walking down memory lane with me. I love the decision. I love talking about it. I love thinking about LeBron's career arc, which is still very much ongoing.
Yeah.
And you know, hopefully we'll see unfold in Orlando as the Lakers try to win the championship this year. Brian Windhorst, read his piece. It's on the front page of ESPN.com, looking back at the 3 days around the decision. Listen to the Hoop Collective podcast, which I have not yet done this week, but I'm going to remedy that shortly with Brian and a cast of characters.
Yeah, Nick Friedel, who was covering the Bulls at the time, he has some pretty interesting feeling of that viewpoint that was on that podcast. So,
well, Nick Friedel's laugh alone is worth it. I would listen to 20 minutes of Nick Friedel just guffawing. Wendy, thank you very much for your time, as always.
Thank you.
It's good to catch up.
Thanks for having me.